What we have for today in Giants of is going to be Rav Sadia Gaon, but there was one piece that we didn't finish last time that I wanted to at least mention. It doesn't quite fit into Gaonim, but it very much fits into the question that led to the whole series of, you know, where does all of this come from? Who did this? Who are these, you know, Chachamim and so on? And that is the origin of Medrash Rabbah, which comes back to the period of the Gaonim, although I don't believe the Gaonim are actually involved in composing it. A lot of it is composed in Eretz Yisrael. Medrash Rabbah, when I use that term Medrash Rabbah, I should explain, there are different kinds of Midrashim. There's Medrash Halacha, which, as it sounds, you know, teaches us Halacha. And then Medrash Agada, which is what we think of as story Medrash, or a nice lesson Medrash. And they're composed by a lot of the same figures, meaning Tanoim, Amoraim, in terms of the original Midrashim. Sometimes you'll see in the Gemara that a particular Tana is more known for Halacha or for Agada. But it's from that group. But it's not as though Rabbi Akiva or Abaye and Rava had a book of Medrash that wasn't done that way. It was taught. And there were shiurim, and there were drashos, but there was no book of it. And it seems like the collections of Medrash Agada, Medrash Halacha really is a separate treatment, the collections of Medrash Agada start in Eretz Yisrael, somewhere shortly after the destruction of the second Beis HaMikdash, that period after, before you ever get to the Gaonim. But during the period of the Gaonim is when we find some of the major compilations we're familiar with. I'm being a little fuzzy on the years, not just because I'm not a historian, but because the historians themselves aren't entirely clear on when these compilations first start to appear. But this is something where we don't have like a known author. Bereishis Rabbah, Vayikra Rabbah, actually, sorry, did I say after the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash? I shouldn't have said after the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, because it is later than that. That's a mistake. Was first century. Yeah, no,
right,
I'm talking
about...
Right,
and the Gaonim are seven, so what
right.
happened... Well,
right, so it's not... Scratch that. It's... Anshei Knesset Gedolah are beginning of the second Beis HaMikdash.
Right.
There are different...
So there were no Midrashim before the Beis HaMikdash?
There are Midrashim, but there aren't books of Midrashim.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. The Midrashim, again, the Midrashim go... Yeah, how far back they go and who wrote them, and that's its own discussion. That's its own, like, year-long shiur on the different types of Medrash and where it comes from and so on. But the books of Medrash is what we're talking about, taking what exists and actually putting it all together and publishing it as a set. So I should not have said after the destruction of the second Beis HaMikdash. What I should have said was after or at the same time or after the conclusion of the Gemara, when Ravina and Ravashi closed the Gemara in the middle of the 6th century, somewhere there, maybe end of the 5th, maybe beginning of the 6th, somewhere in that period of time. Bereishis Rabbah, Vayikra Rabbah are actually believed to be the earliest to be published, and then Devarim Rabbah, and then eventually Shmos Rabbah, Bamidbar Rabbah. And the way we get the dates is not because there's a date on the manuscript. It's not like Seder of Amram Gaon, where he has a date, you know, on the letter where they ask him for this Seder. We learn the date based on things like the type of Hebrew or Aramaic that's used, as well as who quotes them in other writings and who doesn't quote them. That tells you who had access to it. So these compilations of Medrash are put together again by people we have no idea who it is who puts these Midrashim together. With Medrash Halacha we know more, I believe, but with Medrash Agada we don't really know. But the biggest question is, why are they compiling them?
Where are they getting their information from?
So these are right. These are things that Tanaim and Amoraim said.
Yeah, but why weren't they in the Gemara then? They were.
Some of them are.
Ah.
Quite a bit of Medrash shows up in the Gemara.
So the Gemara is first.
The Gemara is published first.
Right. I always thought that the Gemara was publishing Midrashim, but you're saying
right.
Medrash published things
that
were in the Gemara?
So the problem is the use of the word Medrash,
yeah.
And I think you're using the word Medrash to mean the book, And usually people use it to mean the original, the individual medrash, the actual teaching,
okay,
so to speak. So there are midrashim that appear in the Gemara, both Bavli and Yerushalmi. And eventually when they are published as a book, that's a collection of these earlier midrashim after you're already seeing the publication of the Yerushalmi. Yes. Now, it's more than just compiling. Alina knows because she's in the Shir HaShirim Shir. We talked about Shir HaShirim Rabbah, that the compiler of a volume of Medrash does more than just say, okay, I am now taking all the Medrashim, putting them together in a book, and throwing them out there for the world. There's organization. There's a selection of what you're going to include and which Medrashim you're not going to include. It's not as though Bereishis Rabbah has every Medrash on Psukim in Bereishis. There's a lot of thought that goes into it, and a lot of work that goes into it. And the biggest question is, why? Meaning, we've already said, there's a push to publish Mishnah and Gemara for very particular reasons in terms of making sure we're going to have them. But who decided that there was a need to publish Midrashim? Like, where did that come from, that there should be books of Medrash?
I also feel like, doesn't Medrash kind of have like not as like that fact based, like it's kind of like, oh, sometimes like it's true, it's not true, like it doesn't have that solid validation or from other
right. So I wanted to do this without going into the whole question of what Medrash is and what it's not. Medrash has very solid analytical, exegetical techniques. That doesn't necessarily mean that it's describing an event that took place. And I think that's what you're getting at. I mean, you have to realize also, most midrashim are not stories. Most midrashim, certainly when you talk about Medrash Halacha, but also Medrash Agada, is not stories. It's explaining what a pasuk is trying to say in light of words that appear in it, strange words that appear in it, whatever. And it doesn't give you stories. It's just that the midrashim you learn in school, in grade school, when they're teaching you the Parsha, and they say, and here's a medrash about Abraham being thrown into the fiery furnace, and here's a medrash about Yaakov and Esau, and Esau trying to bite Yaakov's neck, or, whatever it is. That, sorry?
They don't even preface it with, this is a medrash.
Right.
Yes and no.
Just hand you a coloring page.
Right. So coloring pages are not so great. That's true. On the other hand, I'm very leery of people who say, well, that's not in the Torah, that's Medrash, because it really doesn't do justice to what Medrash is accomplishing and the insight that Medrash has. People who think, that they're somehow getting a greater access to truth by saying, I just want Pshat, are fooling themselves. Pshat ignores most of what's going on in the text in the attempt to provide a nice simple thing so that you can, feel like you understood it. But it ignores so much of what's going on that Drash is trying to address. On the other hand, Drash is also incomplete, because Drash says, if I can just explain why that is missing a Vav, I'll be really happy, even if it makes no sense in terms of like the rest of the story that's going on around it. They're both incomplete methods. You need both in order to actually, get anywhere in terms of really understanding a pasuk.
What's the time frame of Medrash and Gemara and Mishnah?
Right. So the Midrashim are being taught publicly by Tanoim and Amoraim, the same figures who are in the Mishnah, the same figures who are in the Gemara. The books are composed somewhere towards the end of the period of the Gemara and start to show up. The Medrash Agada I'm talking about again. Medrash Halacha is a whole separate animal that I'm not ready to address. But the Medrash Agada is showing up in print at that point, in print, so to speak, I mean, writing it out. And that's where I wanted to go with this is why? Why is somebody compiling these? What's the goal of compiling Medrash Rabbah? Take a look at number one, please. This is by Dr. Tamar Kadari. It's her doctoral thesis. You can see the title, Amleches Ha'aricha B'Midrash Shir HaShirim Rabbah, which they have a nice English translation in the link, on the redaction of Medrash Shir HaShirim Rabbah. So in this piece from what is a much, much longer paper, she talks about why bodies of Medrash were compiled, this is not her own thesis. This is something that, yeah, there's a lot of academic research on. And I thought it was really a very interesting array of explanations. So I brought it here, and I'm just going to read out from my English translation. She says, in the research, there are four central approaches to the question of the target audience for which the material found in Midrashic compilations was formed. The first approach thinks that the compilations were formed primarily of Midrashim stated before the broad community. The collection of these materials by a later compiler does not change the fact that the material presents oral lectures meant for a broad community of listeners. So what this means is that you would go to shul and you would hear a drasha, and somebody at some point says, you know what, wouldn't it be great if we had these as a resource? We're just going to put them all together in books and publish the books. That's one approach. That's the simplest approach, but it's only one out of four. Second approach goes, in another view, the compilations were formed from debates of scholars and their teachers between the walls of the study hall. It's a Beis Medrash publication. The material is meant for a narrow elite of scholars, and at a later stage it was collected and formed via principles which resemble the style of learning in the study hall. So in other words, it's not meant for the masses. According to this, Medrash Rabba was not meant for just people to pick up and read it. Rather, the same chachamim who are looking at psukim and noticing challenges in them and applying mesora and applying standard methods to come out with midrashic lessons, that's who it's meant for. It's meant to be a more elite type of publication. Third approach, this is the most fascinating one to me, is that the compilations were formed as a professional literature for speakers and teachers. The Midrashim are source books meant to help prepare lessons for the community or for students. This approach further narrows the target of the Midrashim. So in other words, the rabbi sitting there on Thursday night thinking, what am I going to say this Shabbos? He opens up his Medrash Rabbah and he finds Midrashim that he can then use for his, for the drasha. It's meant to be a resource. And then the fourth approach is that the compilations of Medrash combine various materials. They do not represent the sources from which they were combined. The Midrashim represent primarily the work of the compilers and their literary reasons and goals. And what that means is that the one who's compiling the Medrash is trying to teach particular lessons. They're not really trying to just collect all the Midrashim on Bereishis, Vayikra, whatever it is. What they're trying to do is teach certain lessons. It's a sefer with a particular set of goals in mind to convey. So in the Shir HaShirim Shir, when I was talking about Shir HaShirim Rabbah, we saw the idea that Shir HaShirim Rabbah is meant to combat the early Christian idea that they were the replacements for the Jews. And they built on Shir HaShirim. They saw Shir HaShirim as being Hashem rejected the Jews, and now Hashem accepted the church as the new Jews, so to speak. And Shir HaShirim Rabbah goes through Shir HaShirim and sees it as a love song of Hashem's love for the Jews. That's what it's about, and that's why Shir HaShirim Rabbah actually says in it, anytime you find a pasuk and you could interpret it for Shevach, say nice things about the Jews, or Genai, something derogatory, always go L'Shevach. It's a machlokas Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Yehuda, and Shir HaShirim Rabbah follows the approach, I think it's Rabbi Meir, to always be positive in those Midrashim, even though we have non-Shir HaShirim Rabbah Midrashim, which say harsh things about the Jews, which talk about the Egel and link it to Shir HaShirim, and Shir HaShirim Rabbah is not interested in that. It wants to convey this much more positive view of our relationship with Hashem. So in that sense, the compilation of Medrash is not just, here's a body of Midrashim, it's, I'm trying to get across a message, and that's what I'm getting across. Curated, exactly the word. Right, correct. So that's just a little bit about the Midrashim. You know, I can't give you a biography of the compiler, because we don't know who the compiler is, but I wanted us to at least talk about it, because it's compiled during this period of time that we're talking about.
And this applies solely to Midrash Rabbah, not to
correct
any and all Midrash.
Correct. Midrash Halacha is a whole different thing with a whole different identity. And some of the other Midrashim that we have in terms of Midrash Agada are later than Midrash Rabbah. There are some earlier ones also that are not Medrash Rabbah, there's Psikta de Rav Kahana, but like when you think of Medrash Tanchuma as an example, that's a later collection. And some of the stories that you're familiar with, actually, some of the ones that are less anchored in Psukim tend to be from the later bodies of Medrash. Medrash Rabbah tends to have a much greater fealty to the Psukim. Okay, so that was just wanted to at least mention that. But let's talk about Rav Sadia Gaon. Rav Sadia Gaon is such a giant personality in terms of, yeah, affecting what we do as halacha today, affecting what Jews think in terms of machshava, just basic Jewish belief. Everybody has to contend with Rav Sadia Gaon. Like what he said, don't like what he said, doesn't matter. You have to contend with him. The Rambam contends with him, Rav Yehuda Halevi contends with him, Ibn Ezra contends with him, and everybody forward has to somehow deal with Rav Sadia Gaon. He was just this kind of overarching figure, who you learn nothing about in school, unfortunately. But that's, you know, that's what we're trying to fill in here. I brought you in source number 2 from his Emunos Videos.
Can we just have
Yeah, we're gonna do all of that. Oh. We're gonna do all of that. I will tell you though that he's born in 892 in Egypt and he dies in Babel in 942. He only lives 50 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
And he does all that.
And he does all that. Like,
and that was probably a long lifetime.
Maybe not. Remember that infant mortality skews the average lifespan. That plus war. Rav Sadia Gaon, who's only 2 generations later, lives to be 100. But it is startling how much he accomplishes given the short lifespan. It's really striking. So this is just a brief quote from Emunos Videos. It is brought specifically in order to create controversy. That's why I chose it. It's his comments about Gilgul, about reincarnation. He says, Aval Omar, he says, but I say, after bringing previous discussion, he says, Sha'anashim mimisha nikra'im Yehudim. There are people among those who are called Jews. And yes, he's using that type of language on purpose. Mitzasim omrim, I have found that they say, sorry, the behishanos, v'korim oso ha'ataka, they talk about hishanos, which means coming back, sheni, coming back again. They call it ha'ataka, transmigration. V'inyano etzlam, what they think that means is, sheruach Reuven tashuv el Shimon, that Reuven's soul comes back in Shimon, v'achar kach b'levi, v'achar kein b'yehuda. V'yesh mehem rabim sha'omim, and there are many of them who say, yesh pamim shetia ruach ha'adam ba'behema, that a person's soul might come back in an animal, v'ruach ha'behema ba'adam, or an animal soul in a person, u'dvarm rabim mizeha shiga'on v'ha'ir buv. He says, as I translated, the types of foolishness and confusion are legion. He is not a believer. And he goes on at length to spell out what he believes are the mistakes that led people to believe in it. Things like misinterpreting psukim, things like seeing a baby and saying that baby looks like so-and-so who passed away or has the characteristics of so-and-so who passed away. And he says that leads them to believe that this is a Gilgul. And he says, absolutely not.
He doesn't believe in the concept at all. Not that
correct. It is not a thing as far as he's concerned.
I know that the Chofetz Chaim is an achor and achor and achor, but I just happen to be reading his Sefer, and he's totally talks about, like,
yep, absolutely. Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, the Zohar is big on Gilgul. The Arizal was very big on Gilgul. He identified specific Gilgulim.
But they're more Kabbalistic than, let's say, Chofetz Chaim, you could say, is more...
Yes. No, that's true.
I don't know what the word is.
No, that's true. But by the time you get to the time of the Chafetz Chaim, these things have been blended. The Vilna Gaon, who is Litvish Sheva Litvish,
right,
was a Mekubal.
That's true.
You know, the Rama was a Mekubal.
And how did the Vilna Gaon feel about Gilgul?
I believe he was a believer. I'm not 100% sure, but I think so.
So has his opinion taken root or not really?
There definitely is a strain of those who follow it, but no, I think he lost this one in terms of popular opinion. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But
is he such a person that after he says this, everybody has to quote him and then say whether they agree or not?
Yep.
Or they just
yeah.
know?
No, he's a major figure, and they quote him, and they disagree.
Yeah.
Yeah. But his view was a very strong view in his time, but yes, later generations, it becomes less popular. That's for sure true. But I bring it to you, for you, for two things. Number one, he's a philosopher, and he is very driven to rid Judaism of external influence. He's very concerned about ideas that are coming into Judaism from outside, and he believes that Gilgal is one of those things, that it wasn't a Jewish idea, and that it was adopted from people around us. He's also a firebrand, meaning he says what he wants to say, when he wants to say it, how he wants to say it, and if you don't like it, that is not his problem. That's very much the approach that he takes, and it's an approach that continues, in particular, in Sfarad. You see Ibn Ezra does it, you see the Rambam does it. This is what they think, and this is what they're going to say, and they know that there are people who disagree with them, but that's not particularly interesting to them. They just, this is what they believe. And you'll see, we're gonna see his writing, and you'll see the way he comes across. So Sajid Gaon is not impressed with people who disagree with him. A little bit of biography. As I said, he's born in Egypt in 892. His full name is Sajid al-Fayoumi. Sajid al-Fayoumi, Fayoum being his region where he came from in northern Egypt. Actually, his name at one point is written as Said. That was actually the original name, which of course is an Arabic word. I think it means good or happy. I forget. It's either good or happy in Arabic. I don't remember. When he wrote his Egron, his Hebrew dictionary, which we're going to talk about a little bit, he writes his name in the introduction as Said. And only later, that he wrote when he was 20. So only later does he start to use Sadia, which is the name that we're more familiar with. He claims to be a descendant of the tribe of Yehuda, Shevet Yehuda. Rabbi Chanina ben Dosa, he says, is one of his ancestors. He names his own son Dosa. We don't know a whole lot about his youth. We don't know, like, who taught him. You know, who are his rebellion, which, you know, sort of a thing that we normally want to know. At the age of 20, as I said, he compiles or completes this work, which we always call it, and I think I called it last week, Agron. But I read this week the work of a historian named Nehemiah Iloni, who argues that it should be Ha-Egron, not Ha-Agron.
With an Aleph?
I'm still with an Aleph, yeah. Like... it is Hebrew to Arabic, correct.
What is the storage of
Agron? So I think it's like a ma'agar. It's like a storage thing. You're collecting all of these words. Le'egor is to collect. Aleph, Gimel, Resh would be the root. Dictionaries were really, really important back in the day, not just for translation, but in terms of defining terms. Later on, I hope to get to Rav Nassan Baal Ha'aruch, who was a very early Rishon, before Rashi, who compiles what is a very important dictionary called the Aruch. The Rambam, in the first part of Mora Nevuchim, it's basically a dictionary. He goes through terms and defines them and explains what they mean. But this isn't a true dictionary. He actually writes that it is meant for paitanim, for those who are composing poetry, which was a big sport back in the day among scholars, to help them with poetry. Think of like a rhyming dictionary. So he's giving you words to work with. It's written, actually, a lot of it in verse. And here I point you to a very interesting paper. This was new to me when I was preparing this shiur, and I was just blown away. Take a look at source number 3. This paper is called, it's from the Journal of Semitic Studies, Importance of Sajid Gaon's Poetry for the Construction of a Dictionary of Early Medieval Piyut, the example of Esam Mishali. And what blew me away about it is not the contents of the paper. What blew me away about it is the names of the people who are writing this paper. Wout van Beckham, who is Dutch, and from what I was able to find out about him online, seems not to be Jewish. And Naoya Katsumata, from Japan.
Yeah.
From Japan. And it just blows me away. I can't imagine what Rav Sadia Gaon would have thought 1300 years ago, that in 1300 years, somebody from Holland and somebody from Japan are going to want to write something about my liturgical poetry. No, he wouldn't have been happy with that idea, no. But it's just mind-blowing to me that, you know, this is like what they devote their life's work to, is Rav Sadia Gaon's poetry, which among Jews, honestly, that's not what we focus on. We talk about his hashkafa. We talk about what he did in halacha. We talk about his perushim on the chumash. We don't talk about his poems. But apparently maybe we should. But yeah, this is a paper, you can find it online, about his poem specifically, Asam Mishali. You take a look. I brought you an excerpt from it. One of the few excerpts in it that I could bring that would be intelligible to people who aren't holding in Rav Sadia Gaon's poetry. Sadia Gaon undeniably has played a critical role in the transmission of Hebrew poetic tradition from Palestine to Babylonia and indirectly to Spain through both religious and specifically liturgical poetry. This is evident from Menachem Zulai's publication of Sadia's liturgical poetry, Nehemiah Aloni's publication of the Egron, and Aaron Dotan's publication of the remnants of Sadia's, and I'm not going to try to pronounce that, it's an Arabic name. Remember, a lot of what he wrote is in Arabic. In fact, modern scholars of Hebrew poetry have found that Sadia discovered, deciphered, reconstructed, and redacted thousands of new compositions of liturgical poems, piyutim, composed by contemporary paitanim. Thousands. Which has led to the generally accepted conclusion that Sadia wished to play a prominent role in establishing criteria for eloquent Hebrew language and verse. I can't get over it. With, you know, Holland and Japan, this is, you know, what they're... I mean, the fellow from Holland did his doctorate at Hebrew U.
Did any of his poems become canonized in the Siddur or something?
So that's what I was thinking about, do we actually say them? We do a lot of Rabbi Elazar HaKalir, we do some from Yanai, we do from others. And I couldn't think in the Siddurim that I use, I couldn't think of any that that are from him. I wonder though if you would look more broadly at some of the Ashkenazi ones that are only said in like Clanton Park, they say Krovitzes and things like that. I wonder if there are, and I'm just not familiar with it. I don't know. It's a good question. Probably. Okay.
Was this an attempt from him to, because he was concerned with outside influences, to sort of give Jews like something eloquent and intellectual to focus on internally and not to go like the same way that he was, you know, concerned
right.
with outside influences?
Right. It's a good question. I don't think so. I'm thinking about how others write about the Piyutim, and particularly Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, who is, you know, a century later, where they saw poetry as a way to express the beauty of the Hebrew language and its perfection as the language of Hashem, the Lashon HaKodesh. Rabbi Yehuda Halevi in the Kuzari has a section which is either fascinating or mind-numbing, depending on your approach to Hebrew grammar, where he wants to prove that Hebrew is a divine language based on how perfect the words are and the grammar is for the meter needed for perfect poetry. Like, it was a big deal in their world. I think it's more about something that we would view as very academic as opposed to something popular. Mm-hmm. That would be my guess. But I'm not enough of an expert to really say definitively. He did other things that were for popular reading and for popular encouragement, absolutely. I don't know that the poems are towards that end. At the age of 23, he begins his public opposition to Karaism, and he writes a polemic against the teachings of Anan ben David. Anan ben David is generally viewed as the founder of Karaism, although we'll have to talk about that.
Explain what it was.
I'm going to. Don't worry. We have not gotten there yet. That's about to happen. He moves from Egypt to Israel Israel? Babel. I think Babel. Well, I'm just wondering why I wrote Israel in my notes, but it has to be Babel. I don't believe he lived in Israel at any point. I'll have to check on that, but I believe it's Babel.
He went to Babel and then he was kicked out.
Yeah, he does. Well, we'll get to that. Not today, but we will get to that issue. Okay, so what I want to do, as opposed to just talking about Rav Sadia, is talk about a lot of the tumult that's going on in his day, which is going to help us to understand him and to understand a lot of what's going on in this period among the Gaonim, because the Jewish world is a mess at that point. It helps us understand the growth of publishing Sfarim. It helps us understand their focus on clarifying what do Jews believe, what don't Jews believe. It's because things are really such a mess. And it starts with the 7th century and the growth of Islam. I mean, you could trace it, I suppose, to the Khorban and the scattering of Jews everywhere and blame it on that. But in particular, Islam has a major impact on Jewish communities. Mohammed tries to get Jews at first to follow him. And initially, in the charter in Islam, in going back to the year 623, he says Jews can continue to believe in Judaism. However, he gets frustrated because the Jews are not buying it and they're not, going along with him. And he ends up fighting wars against Jews, most famously the fortress in Khaybar in Saudi Arabia in 629. He massacres the Jews there. After his time, Caliph Omar exiles the Jews from lands that have been conquered by the Muslims. It's not just us. He exiles the Christians also, but equal opportunity. And Omar is very successful. He's conquering the Persians in Syria, in Israel, in Egypt, Iraq, Iran. And in 637, he sets up the Pact of Omar, which is really important for a lot of things, but in particular, it's what gives Jews dhimmi status. You've heard the term dhimmi, D-H-I-M-M-I. It's the term for Jews living as sort of second-class citizens with certain protections, but a whole lot of rules about mixing with Muslims, about paying special taxes to them, and so on. It's the terms for Jews being allowed to live in the Muslim empire. It would be interesting to do a comparison of Jewish rules for the Ger Toshav and Muslim rules for the Dhimmi. But in any case, that's one major, major impact on Jews in this area. The fact that they're conquering so much and they're colliding, Islam is colliding with Judaism, has this great impact. But also, there are strains within the Jewish community. There are problems within the Jewish community. Economic issues. We talked about the fact that they have to support the Gaon and they have to support the Yeshivot and all of that, and that becomes an issue. There are political issues within the community. There are all sorts of challenges, and it leads to, interestingly, what I guess you could call Jews for M, Jews for Mohammed. You had these groups that they're sort of blends of Islam and Judaism. I'll give you one example. There was a group known as the Isunians. They started either the year 680 or the year 740, depending on, we know which caliph was the caliph at the time, but it was Marwan the first or Marwan the second. So that determines whether this is late 7th century or mid 8th. But there's a fellow named Ovadia, who also is known as Abu Isa il-Isfahani, who claimed that he was a prophet. He claimed that he was an emissary of the Mashiach. At times, maybe he was the Mashiach, made that claim. The Rambam mentions him, as we'll discuss. And his followers believed in Islam and in Christianity, as well as Judaism. He changes halacha. He requires prayer 7 times a day, because you have that pasuk in Tehillim, Sheva Bayom Hilal Ticha, 7 times a day I sing to you, God. He forbade eating meat and drinking wine because of the story of Yonatan ben Rechav in Yirmiyahu Lamed Hei. He used a solar calendar instead of a lunisolar calendar. Very interesting fellow. Banned divorce entirely. I guess that came out of Christianity, I'm not really sure. And his problem came when he planned a revolt against the Muslim government. That tends to be, where these people get into trouble, right? You think of like Shabtai Tzvi, much later. So, he forms an army and he attacks, the Muslim empire, and he's defeated by them and he's done.
And it really is a big movement?
Oh, yes. I mean, the Rambam writes about his movement that he has thousands of people. Whether that's literal or not, but that's, we'll see the Rambam. Actually, we'll see the Rambam now. You had quite a few people arise at this time in the Jewish world claiming to be Mashiach. The Rambam writes about that in source number 4. This is from the Igeret Teiman, his letter to the Jews of Yemen. And reading out my English translation, because I think we're going to run out of time, and I want to make sure to at least get through this point of it, and then the Karaites will have to wait till next time. But the Rambam says, you should know that in the beginning of the Arab Empire, meaning he's talking about the beginning of Islam, a man arose from the bank of the river. I don't know which river he's referring to here. It could be the Euphrates, it could be the Nile, I have no idea. And said he was Mashiach. And about 10,000 Jews went with him. He's talking about this fellow, Al-Isfahani. His sign was that that's a mistake in my translation of it. I was writing way too quickly. He went to bed. Oh, that's the typo. That's why. It's not a mistranslation. It's just a typo. He went to bed as a mitzvah, and he awoke healthy. So suddenly his tzaraas disappeared, and that was his miracle. His pursuit, meaning his attempts to become Mashiach, was not completed. His counsel did not endure. And likewise, a man arose in the west, in the land of Fez, right, Morocco, 48 years ago, saying that he was the herald and emissary of Mashiach. He said that Mashiach would be revealed that year. His words did not come true, and new troubles began for the Jews because of him. Someone who was there for all of it told me about it. About 10 years before this, in the lands of Spain, the region of Cordova, a man declared that he was Mashiach. Destruction almost came upon the, quote, enemies of Israel. It's a euphemism. Because of him. About 30 years before this, one arose in France and said he was Mashiach. He performed signs, as they thought, and the French killed him, and with him they killed from the holy communities, meaning Jews end up paying the price every time somebody claims that he is Mashiach. And the Rambam is writing against it, but this is what we're talking about. The Rambam himself is 200 years after Rav Sadia Gaon. But the point that I'm making is not about the Rambam's time, but to say this kind of thing is going on during this period, and it causes tremendous, tremendous trouble. And where we're going to go next time, I hope, in the beginning, is we'll talk about the origin of the Karaites, and that will bring us to Rav Sadia Gaon's initial clash with the Karaites, and in particular, we're going to talk about the calendar controversy of the years 921, 922, in which it seems, head of a yeshiva in Eretz Yisrael claims that the Luach is wrong, our calendar is wrong, and wants a different day for Pesach and a different day for Yom Kippur, and Rav Sadia goes to war against him. So that'll be, God willing, next time. Okay? Okay. So let's talk Parsha.